WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Since jazz plays a very important part in your fiction, I'd like to hear about how you first heard jazz in Czechoslovakia.
As for myself personally, I suppose I first heard jazz on a record, which I bought in a local store, and which was called I've Got a Guy, Chick Webb and his orchestra. And of course I had no idea of what it was, and I didn't know that the singer on that record was Ella Fitzgerald, who at that time was about 17 or 18. But I immediately took to it, and it seemed to me that I had never heard anything so beautiful. You know, the saxophones, that was a sound that I had never encountered before. So that was a sort of moment of revelation.
You took up alto yourself and belonged to a band. How did you find out what the music was like? Was it strictly through the records?
Well, first of all, I didn't take up the alto, but the tenor.
Oh.
And I was not alone in simply finding this new music. There were many young boys like me. And of course, we knew about orchestras who played in Prague, you know. In those days, that was in 1939 when we started, jazz was synonymous with swing, you know. We first knew it as swing. And of course, that was a great craze all over Europe. So in Prague, there were several good orchestras at the time. But American records were very hard to get, you know. You could get them occasionally until Pearl Harbor, actually. We could still buy them during the war, not after Pearl Harbor. But most records we had were Czech. And these Czech swing bands and the Czech swing music was, of course, a sort of imitation of American music. But since there is a great musical tradition in Czechoslovakia, so the bands were not bad at all, you know, and they sound even today, some of them sound quite well. So we got to learn about jazz mostly through the Czech recordings and also by listening to Western stations. But since the war broke out only about half a year after I first had my first experience with jazz, so most Western stations were, of course, jammed. And also they were difficult to get on the radios that we had. So the most important jazz station for us was Radio Stockholm, because they had regular jazz programs and they were not jammed. That was a neutral country. And also there were some Swedish films that were imported into the German, you know, the Czechoslovakia, of course, didn't exist during the war. It was called the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia. So we had a few Swedish films, and I remember in particular one which was called in Swedish, Swing It, Magistern, Swing It. Swing It, Teacher, Swing It. And I must have seen that, well, I don't know, 5 times, 10 times. I just was in the cinema all the time. And that featured a singer who then was very young, about my age. She must have been 16, 17. And her name was Alice Babs Nielsen. And she's quite a big name still, you know. After the war, she even recorded with Duke Ellington. And that she became one of our first, you know, ideals, you know, the big Swedish singer. We had such singers too. There was a woman, a young woman in those days called Inka Zemánková, whom we considered to be the queen of jazz. And that's a sad story, because she remained faithful to jazz. And after the war, she was very popular during the war. And after the war, she decided that she had to learn really to sing. So she went to took some music lessons and became a real accomplished singer using all her voice registers, all that. But she was politically so absolutely naive that she didn't even know that there was a political change in 1948 when the communists took over. And of course, their attitude towards jazz were very similar to the Nazi attitude. And so she wanted to have a comeback, you know. She studied singing for 5 years. She didn't appear in public. After 5 years, she had her first concert in the Lucerna Hall, which is a big music hall in Prague. And she sang. And of course, there was an applause. Everybody was enthusiastic about her coming back to the stage. And she really sang much better than in the old days during the war. And she was so happy that the reception was so great that she did an encore, and she sang one of the choruses in scat. And right after that, she was dragged off from the stage by a member of the Young Communist League. And she was not allowed to sing in Prague for many years afterwards. She had to live in the border regions and sing in little pubs and nightclubs. Then she moved to Poland, where the situation was better for jazz and singers. And she became quite well known in Poland. And then in the early 60s, with the liberalization, I had a program on the Prague radio. Well, I was a frequent visitor on the Prague radio. And they had a program which writers were asked to do a sort of one-hour disc jockey program, selecting the music they like. And I had this idea of, instead of selecting music, I selected female voices, singers, you know, voices of female jazz singers. And I called it Alone with Female Voices. And I went into the archives of the radio building, and I picked up all these old wartime recordings of Inka Zemánková, Milada Pilátová, and others. And the program was such a big success because all members of my generation who hadn't heard these voices for many years suddenly, you know, heard them again. So the radio was flooded with letters. And that made it possible for Inka to make a real comeback after 20 years. She was then in the early 50s, and she's now very popular.
Let's go back to the 40s again during the war. At the time when you were becoming very involved with jazz, both as a listener and as a musician, the Nazis, of course, found jazz to be a very reprehensible, amoral form of music. Can you tell us a little bit about why they objected to it and the form that those objections took?
Well, I think you can approach that from a, let's say, philosophical point of view or a political point of view. And I am not much of a philosopher. So philosophically speaking, of course, jazz is a music that is based on improvisation to a large extent, on expression of your personality. But of course, on the other hand, it's also collective music, you know. So it's hard to say. You can always say that that it contains some sort of a sound of freedom, which certainly is there, you know, because if you play in a good band, and if you are a good musician, of course, which I never was, but if you are a good musician, so I suppose the feeling of freedom that this music gives you is great. You can find that in, let's say, symphonic orchestras. There the feeling is also great, but it's obviously based on something else. So philosophically speaking, it somehow expresses some sort of human freedom. And of course, all the totalitarian regimes rest on the suppression of human freedom. So there is something inherently alien. But politically speaking, of course, it's the music that was created by blacks, and it came from America. So you can easily imagine that an ideology like the Nazi ideology, which was based on racial superiority, they didn't talk very much about Negro races because that was not their problem. There were no blacks in Germany. But obviously the blacks were a lower race, you know. I don't know whether they were considered lower than the Jews or not, because, as I say, they never had anything to do with the blacks. But certainly that was a music created by, you know, what they call primitive people. And moreover, it came from America, which was their enemy. So the official description of jazz was Judo-Negroid music. So you can see that they probably placed the Negroes on the same level as the Jews. So naturally they couldn't like it and they couldn't agree it. But on the other hand, they couldn't very well, you know, ban it. Because by the time they came to power, jazz, or elements of jazz, permeated every other sort of popular music. So, for instance, the most popular German composer of the times, I don't want to say a Nazi composer because I don't know that he was a member. He's still alive and he's still very popular. His name was Peter Kreuder. So he did write a sort of popular music which had very strong jazz elements. You know, he used the saxophones, and of course it was syncopated, and you had trumpets, you know, doing all kinds of sounds. So obviously they couldn't ban it. But they were against it. They certainly didn't encourage it. And there were cases of men, of musicians, German musicians, who actually were in prison, sent to concentration camps because of playing a kind of jazz that sounded too wild to the ears of the local supervisors. And, you know, so, for instance, I mentioned in my book a sort of set of rules that were issued by... these rules never applied to the entire German Reich, you know. This was something, this was a local affair in one of the Gaus, you know, the Gau that's like, let's say, in Canada, a province or a state in the United States, because the Germany was divided into... So the local Gauleiter, who obviously was a fanatic Nazi, issued a set of rules. Obviously, they came out of his own head. And they applied only to his Gau. And the set of rules that I have in my book is a sort of paraphrase, because I wrote from memory. But it's very true to the actual fact. So, for instance, rule number 10, that all light orchestras and dance bands are advised to restrict the use of saxophones of all keys and to substitute for them the violoncello, the viola, or possibly a suitable folk instrument. Well, that is something that this issue, this rule actually was issued by this man. And what's perhaps ridiculous, it was reiterated by some of the communist critics after the communist takeover. Because to all these people who are concerned about purity, either of race or class, origin or ideology, the saxophone sounds suspicious. Because it's the sound is something between brass and reed, you know. So they call it, they said that it was simply it wasn't a pure sound, you know, it was a mixture. So the Nazis didn't like this mixed sound because of their pure race theories. And some of the fanatical communists or Stalinists didn't like it because, again, it was not pure. So they actually, after the communist takeover, they started in Prague an official government jazz band, which was called Jaroslav Ježek Band. Jaroslav Ježek, poor man, was one of the pioneers of jazz in Czechoslovakia, and actually he died in the United States because his band played in a theater, the Theater of Voskovec and Werich, which was one of the most, well, certainly the most popular musical theater in Prague, and they were strongly anti-fascist. They produce anti-fascist plays, and Ježek composed jazz music and beautiful songs, foxtrots and blues, you know, with political lyrics. And naturally, when the Nazis came, they had to flee. They all went to the United States. Mr. Voskovec, who is still in America, he's known as George Voskovec. And you can see him on the TV very often, and he played in movies like The 12 Angry Men or The Boston Strangler. And last year he was in a Christmas show about he played the father of Virgin Mary or something. You know. He's a very fine man. So Ježek went with him. He died in America. And that, ideologically speaking, was his good luck, because when the communists came, he was safely dead. So they used his name for an orchestra which was to produce the right kind of Czech socialist jazz. And in that band, they tried to replace the saxophones with the violoncellos. Of course, you can't do that, because the sound is entirely different. And also, I said something in this book, that it's much easier to learn to play the saxophone than to play the violoncello. And John Sweat said that shows that I don't know much about... of course, I didn't mean that to... If you want to play the saxophone really well, of course it's difficult and you have to be as talented as if you want to play the violoncello. But technically, it simply is more difficult to play a string instrument where you have to form the tones. You know, you have to be pretty clever with your fingers. Whereas on the saxophone, it's obviously technically easier. So, you know, to young people who want to play, and very, very soon, you know, very quickly, to want to them to learn the violoncello, which takes several years before you can do anything. So it was ridiculous. And the band existed for only about half a year, and then it collapsed.
What are some of the other specifications in the aesthetic manifesto that was issued in the one town that you were telling us about?
Well, for instance, they were all, and again, this is something that the Nazis shared with the communists, they are all against any sort of mutes, you know, the wah-wah and in-head and all these all these devices that change the natural tone of the trumpet into something that, you know, they called Negro squeaking or whatever, you know. So they are always against that. Jungle tones, you know, sort of Duke Ellington jungle sounds, of course, made them mad. And it's interesting that both these camps, which obviously ideologically are supposed to be so different, have the same attitude. To them, you know, both to the Nazis and to the communists, jazz, of course, you must not forget that the spokesman of the fanatical Nazis and the fanatical communists never knew anything about jazz, you know. They just listened to some wah-wah sound and they decided that this was a primitive, barbaric sound, which was not proper for the cultured Central European people. So they were against such things. In this set of rules, I also say that the double bass must be played solely with the bow in so-called jazz compositions. And for instance, the ruling against scat singing. Actually, a Czech guitar player, Vicherek, was sent to a concentration camp and spent about 2 years in a concentration camp because in a nightclub he once sang a song in scat. And there were some local, some SS men sitting there and they decided that this was a provocation because what sort of singing is that? You know, it sounds like a illiterate Negro, you know, making strange sounds. So they sent him to camp, actually, for scat singing.
That's very interesting, because you think of folk music with protest lyrics as being the music that's going to be banned because it has lyrics that are speaking very explicitly about the government and what's wrong with it. But scat singing is just syllables. There's no literal message in that at all.
No, but, you know, to a man who believes in the theories of a super race, very articulate German race, if you see a man who is making sounds that make no sound, so that's insulting to him. You know, you say, well, he sings like an idiot, so that's a provocation. And to a, let's say, Stalinist communist critic who hears these sounds, and he has a vague memory of having heard some American records with some Negro making the same sounds, obviously someone from the imperialist West. So the associations are different, but also it's improper, you know. It's a provocation.
In the doctrine that you quote in your book, it also mentions that people should avoid singing Jewishly gloomy lyrics.
Yeah. Well, because all totalitarian regimes are very optimistic, you know. And the blues, you know, is of course, they thought it was gloomy. Anyway, it's not, it doesn't sound joyful, you know. The Nazis had an official, you know, leisure time organization, which was called Kraft durch Freude, which means power through joy. And of course, the communists in art, in literature, in music, had an official doctrine that socialist art must be optimistic because there is no reason to be pessimistic. Now, after the revolution, everything is okay, so there is no reason for pessimism. So they were concerned about the blues, you know, and about the mood, which was anathema to them.
Now, I know that you know of Nazis who enjoyed jazz themselves and who were studying various discographies to see which were the sidemen on the records that they had in their collection. Can you tell us a little bit about the nature of the German underground of jazz?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't use the word Nazis, you know, for the people for the German soldiers I saw enjoying jazz, because if you are a German and if you are a man, so you are simply drafted into the army. And then, of course, all the others saw you as a Nazi soldier, but many of these people were not Nazis, you know, necessarily. Nazis were, you know, in the SS, in the Gestapo, and in the party, of course, first of all. But I did see quite a few German soldiers in my native town who would come to the pub where our band was rehearsing, and they would listen to it, obviously, with great enjoyment. And a few times we were even approached by them, and they told us, well, we like this music too, and we have just been in Athens in Greece, and we were given this sheet music, and would you exchange it for use? And they obviously traveled across Europe with their unit, you know, and they were exchanging this sheet music. And there is a very well-known story about Paris, you know, where a German officer, and I'm not really sure whether he was an SS man or an ordinary army officer. I think he was just an army officer by the name of Schulz Kern, actually covered up for Delaunay, you know, who is the author of the first chess discography. And I understand there were even some American soldiers who hit in Paris, you know, were parachuted or something, and they helped him put together the discography. And Schulz Kern is still alive. They call him now Dr. Jazz, you know. And he was a German soldier. And there is something which many people don't believe, but it's documented. Unfortunately, this has never been published in English, but there was a jazz band in Buchenwald, which was one of the worst Nazi concentration camps, a swing band, you know, a big band, which performed for a certain time, I don't know for how long, but I have read an article by a member of that band who is Czech, and most of the musicians were Czech and French, because those were the people who were in the camp. So, and of course there was this famous band in Theresienstadt, the Jewish ghetto, who called themselves the Ghetto Swingers, and only one of them survived, Mr. Vogel, who I believe is still alive in the States, you know. So there was a jazz underground, and of course among the Czechs, you know, the students, there was a great number of amateur bands, you know, mostly student bands in little towns that performed. That was a real underground.
What was the nature of the bond, if any, that was formed between the young Czechs who listened to jazz and the young German soldiers who also listened to jazz, who, aside from this interest in jazz, were basically enemies?
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't want to create the impression that in the German army there were thousands of such people, you know. I think that I saw them on only two or three occasions. And always just two were sitting in the pub, you know, being very careful. And so to us, of course, they came as a surprise, and we felt a sympathy for them, because obviously these were people who were in the uniform, because they couldn't be out of uniform, and who liked the same kind of music as we, and we felt that they actually were not so much of an enemy if they could like this music, you know. But they were certainly exceptional, you know. But there was a bond, we felt that there was a sort of bond between us and them, because they liked the thing that we liked, and that we liked for two reasons. First, that it was simply beautiful, and it was an expression of our feelings, and second, that the Nazis hated it, you know, the Nazi oppressors. And suddenly you had these German soldiers who shared the same attitude, so obviously they couldn't be ideologically on their side, really, you know. But as I say, I don't want to say that this was a mass movement in the German army, certainly not, you know.
Was the population surprised when the Russians came in after the Germans left and had similar aesthetic doctrines that were being laid out as the Germans, where free art or anything expressing pessimism was going to be banned again?
Well, you know, that's one of the great and tragic ironies of revolutionary movements, that before they win, they gain support very often from jazzmen, musicians, artists, you know, people who are in the free arts and who think that the revolution is going to bring them even more freedom than they already possess. And they invariably are disappointed, because the revolution is a totalitarian thing. It's a violent thing, and it suppresses everyone who deviates in any way. And once it gets established, so it creates its own power structure, and then the types that you see in all power structures become the bosses in the post-revolution power structure too. It requires a certain type of mentality to be the boss and to suppress the others. And then, of course, everything is... And then all these careerists, you know, come in, and they are the ones who spoil everything. So, for instance, jazz, as I told about this Jaroslav Ježek, I told you about him. These people, Voskovec, Verich, Ježek, they were not communists, but they were certainly left socialists, you know. And after the communist takeover, well, Voskovec had to flee again to the States because of his views, you know, which were socialist, not communist. Verich remained, and for several years he was not allowed to act. And jazz, suddenly being seen as something American, was simply suppressed. So it's a big disappointment, and it's a lesson that people should learn before it's too late, because then it is too late. But now, of course, they were, I am talking about the 50s, you know, the time when Stalin was still alive. And in those days, simply jazz was American music, and as such it was out. But then after Stalin died, so the situation changed a little, you know, and jazz became more and more accepted. But by the time, jazz had been replaced in popularity by, you know, rock and roll and these more recent types of music. So that in the early 50s, jazz still in Czechoslovakia still had a mass audience. And that was the second reason why the party was against it. It was American music, and it had a vast audience. So they were afraid that jazz would somehow influence young people, as it did during the war. But then when jazz lost the mass audience, so they turned their attention towards rock and roll. And there were people imprisoned for playing rock and roll. And they somehow forgot about jazz. So that in the 60s, actually there were international jazz festivals in Prague every year, to which famous and great American jazzmen were invited, and of course Swedish and other jazzmen. And that was officially tolerated because simply the audience shrunk to, you know, people who simply are jazz fans, and they are not numerous.
So it seems that there always is a music that is going to be dictated against, and that people are going to have to flee the country because they play it, or be imprisoned if they continue to play it.
Well, you know, one of the ironic things is that no totalitarian regime ever developed any sort of music that would appeal to people, and especially to young people. The Nazis, the fascists in Italy, the communists had always problems with music that originated in the West.
My impression is that, for instance, in the Soviet Union, there are government-approved rock bands that are very warmed over lukewarm imitations of American rock bands, where everything is so smoothed out and controlled that there couldn't be anything threatening about it anymore.
Well, that's very true about Czechoslovakia, too. They simply cannot ban it because, you know, obviously it's a music that is loved by hundreds of thousands of young people. If they ban it, so what happens is that they antagonize all the young people. So they try to, as you say, dilute it somehow, make it more palatable to the bosses, you know. So that's the same phenomenon exists in Czechoslovakia. If you listen to the recent records from Prague of so-called rock music, so it's not really rock, you know. It's very smooth, and the lyrics are again optimistic, you know, and very sentimental, very kitschy. You know, it's terrible. Yes, but besides, of course, there exist unofficial rock bands, amateur rock bands, which play the, you know, the acidest rock that you can possibly imagine. But they are amateur bands that just don't appear in public. They play for themselves and for their friends.
Now, you've been living in Canada and have been doing a fairly extensive traveling through America, and that's given you the opportunity to hear jazz in the country of its origin. Has your attitude towards it, or your feelings about what kinds of climate or factors create jazz, changed at all in your American experiences?
Well, you know, my American experience with jazz was very strange, because for the first time in my life, I was able suddenly, you know, to see in person people who were legendary names to me. For instance, if you remember, he's still alive, the bass player Bob Hagart, you know. He became very famous in Bohemia during the war because of a recording of a tune called Big Noise from Vinetka, if you remember that. That was just drums and bass and his whistling, you know. It was one of his things that he did. And to us, Bob Hagart was just a mystical, almost, name. And actually, when I was about 16, I wrote a long poem which was called Hagart's Inspiration. That's another recording by him. Of course, I knew nothing about him, and so I created a sort of musician who has an inspiration, and the inspiration is, of course, a girl, and he composes a song. And it was a long, epic poem. And then I came to Toronto, and a band, which was called the World's Greatest Jazz Band, came to town, and Bob Hagart was with them. So I couldn't resist, and after the concert, I went to the dressing rooms, and he was there, and he had a cold like I have today. And I told him that many years ago I listened to his records as a young boy and that you always admired him. And he said, oh, where was that? And I said, in Prague. And he said, oh, I see, in Prague. And I could see that he didn't know where that really was, you know, because these chessmen travel all the time. And all they know about the countries they come to are hotels and airports, you know, and bus stations, and it just gets everything mixed. So when I saw Joe Venuti, who was also a legendary figure of Bud Freeman, and of course Duke Ellington and Count Basie and all these Jimmy Rushing and these people. So it's a very strange feeling to suddenly be able to see them. And, you know, there is an illusion which has existed always in Europe, that all these people are terribly rich, because they are so famous, you know. And then you come in Toronto to a sort of pub, you know, and you see suddenly this supposedly very rich man like Joe Venuti, you know, fiddling there for... So you get a better perspective, and you suddenly see that they are hardworking musicians, you know, who have created so much, so many beautiful things. And
for you, both the musicians and the music became metaphors of freedom and of beauty, and then to encounter the musicians as mortals who had their definite flaws as well as their creativity. Was that a difficult thing to reckon with?
Well, I didn't see any flaws, unless you call having a cold a flaw, you know. I like them terribly, you know. If you know, with Joe Venuti, that was such a great thing, because when I saw him, he was already 80, you know, and he still played beautifully. And I was sitting at a table next to an old man, and I could see that he wanted to tell me something. And I said, you know, I was Joe Venuti's friend when we were young somewhere, and we played in the same band. And then Joe Venuti came to the microphone and saw him and said, oh, my old friend, come here. And this man, reached under the table and pulled out a trombone, and he went onto the stage and they started playing together, you know, two old friends, very old people by that time. And he had false teeth, so then he developed trouble with his teeth, but he put them back and they played. So I didn't see any flaws. They were just very marvelous old men who still produce great music. So to me, when I say that they were legends to me, legendary, I could even enjoy them even more when the legend came alive, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joseph Svorecki, the Czech emigre writer now living in Canada. And his most recent novel, which you've probably heard about, is called The Bass Saxophone. I had read in an interview with you that you said that you became a writer because you weren't satisfied with your musicianship. So out of your musical frustration, you took up writing. Is that really true?
Well, that is true. You know, I really, when I was 15, 16, 17, and I was trying to play what we then call jazz, and nowadays you probably wouldn't think very much of it, it was simply swing. So when I realized that I wasn't good enough to become a really professional musician, and so I started writing about it. And I must have started about 10 jazz novels when I was 16, 17. I never finished them. And, of course, I soon realized that my powers, that I had much, much greater powers as a writer.
Now, in your country, Czechoslovakia, your literature became as controversial as jazz was. In, I think it was 1958, your book, The Cowards, was published, and it was much acclaimed and well-read. And then the climate turned around, and it was... what was the reaction to it?
Well, it was banned, you know. It came out shortly before Christmas. For about a month, nothing happened, and then suddenly in January it was banned, and I was under a barrage of, reviews, very, very... bad reviews in the party press, and I was fired from my job because of that book. And several editors who were responsible for the publishing of the book were fired, and there was a great purge in the publishing houses. And it was a major clash between the party and people who just wanted to publish new, good books.
What was it in your book that you think was most offensive to the government?
Well, that's the same thing as you were saying about jazz being not political and having no protest lyrics, and yet, you know, inciting so much so much hatred. The book, the book is now in print in English. You know, Echo Press has just published a new edition, so you can read it. It's not political, but you would have to know something about the socialist realist, you know, literature that was mandatory at that time. You know, a socialist realism is something that has never been defined, but it simply means that the writer must not follow his own vision, his own instincts, his own knowledge, but he must follow rules like this Decalogue. So, and my book is about the last days of the war. And the official version was that the courageous Czechs were fighting the cowardly Germans, and then the Great Red Army came and saved them all. That was the official version. And if you wrote a book about it, so you had to have what they call positive heroes, the courageous Czechs, the negative heroes, the bad Germans, and then the Superman, the Red Army man. And of course, I lived through those days. I was in the Czech underground and so on. So I saw it with my own eyes and I described it as I saw. And there were some courageous Czechs, others were cowards. And the Germans by that time were beaten, you know, and they were just trying to save themselves. Is not worried about the SS, you know. The SS came on the very last day and they were very vicious. And of course, that's another chapter. But the regular army, you know, that was the last days of the war. And when they have survived for so long, so they wanted to get as quickly as possible to the Americans, because they knew that American captivity was something quite different than Russian captivity. And then came the Red Army. Well, first of all, there were no Russians in that army that liberated my native time. They were people from the Soviet republics in Asia, you know. Only the officers were Russians. And of course, they were fighting soldiers, so they were dirty. They drank a lot. They were after girls, you know. They were like any other normal soldiers. They stole watches, because at the time there was a great shortage of watches in the... So, you know, so I simply described that not with any intention to slander the army. In fact, if you read it, you will read a passage in which I describe a Red Army band, which plays some sort of folk music, probably Georgian or something, because these people are not Russians, and which I like tremendously, and I even compare it to jazz. So if you know me, you know that if I compare something to jazz, I don't mean... to be slanderous. But since the Red Army in my novel appeared as it actually was, so that was considered, you know, an insult and slander, and the fact that I didn't mention that they were Russians was slanderous, and that was the reason for the explosion.
You lost your job because of that book. Was any other thing done to your person during your career in Czechoslovakia?
Well, I lost my job, and of course I was not permitted to publish anything for about five years. And for a few days it looked as if I would be arrested. You know? There were, you know, indications that, because I was called terrible names, I was called a fascist, an imperialist agent, and even an anti-Semite, you know, which is very ridiculous in my case. And so all kinds of names, because these people who write for totalitarian press don't think, they just use labels, you know, and there is a wide assortment of those labels, and once you do something, so they put all those labels on you, you may be a Jew and you still may be an anti-Semite and whatever, you know. So for a few days it looked as though I could be arrested, but the times were not really well suited for that. That was after Stalin died and after the 20th Congress in the Soviet Union. So they just fired me, and as I say, I wasn't allowed to publish anything. But I got another job, you know, from a man who was a Communist Party member, but a marvelous guy who in his youth used to be a surrealist, you know. And these were always good. So he gave me a job. And when the party learned about it, so they ordered him to dismiss me. And he pleaded with them and said, well, you know, he's still young and he didn't know that he was doing something so bad. And so they eventually said, all right, keep him, but you must lower his salary. So he had to lower my salary. But he made up for it at the end of the year because he gave me a bonus, you know. And there are many funny stories connected with that book, you know.
What point did you realize that you needed to leave the country?
Well, after the Soviet invasion in 1968, because that I saw very clearly, I have considerable political experience, first-hand experience, and I saw that that was the end of anything in Czechoslovakia, that they decided to simply make an end to this process of liberalization of socialism, which would be more human and so on. So I saw that for me as a writer, there was simply no future. If I had been a medical doctor or something, so I may have stayed, you know. But as a writer, I would be forced either to live in the underground, you know, and of course with all the consequences which that means in such a state. And the consequences are being harassed by the police all the time, being questioned every week, you know, and so on, and having no job, having to accept money from friends, and that which exposes you to the danger of being called a parasite. It's a terrible existence. Or to recant, you know, and write something they would like me to write, which I would never do. So I have friends in both camps, you know, some who simply never recanted and they live a sort of marginal existence. Some are in jail. For instance, Václav Havel, a very good friend of mine, a great playwright, was sentenced last year to 4.5 years in jail for what they call anti-state activity, which consisted in his challenging the government to respect the Czechoslovak constitution and the international agreements that the government signed, like the Helsinki Agreement. So he's now in jail. And he's a really courageous man. You know, he was offered a job in New York by a great theatrical producer. I think that Miloš Forman, the filmmaker, helped him to that offer. And the government was willing to let him go. You know, although by the time he was already sentenced and in jail. And he said that he would go if they dropped the charges against him and all his co-defendants, there were 5 co-defendants, and if they released them from jail too. And of course the government wouldn't do that because they would lose face, so he decided to stay in jail rather than go to the United States unless all his friends go with him and unless the charges be dropped, because he's not guilty of any crime.
So he's still in jail?
He's still in jail, and I'm afraid he's a typical political prisoner, but they treat him as a common criminal.
Is it hard for you to be living away from your country?
Well, it's not for me, because, you know, for me, Czechoslovakia, the Bohemia that I knew and that I loved, does not exist anymore. This is an occupied country where, the Russians keep, 50,000 soldiers, only 20 miles from Prague. It's an occupied country, and it's not a free country. Art is absolutely without any freedom. So to me, it's no longer the Bohemia that I felt happy in. And here in the West, for instance, in Toronto, Toronto is a very nice small Czech town because there are 15,000 Czechs there. We have a Czech theater, and as you know, we have a Czech publishing house there. So I feel much more at home now in Toronto than I would feel in Prague.
You've had a number of visits through different cities in America. What has struck you or surprised you about American culture?
Well, that's, of course, a big question. Well, I have been a sort of student of American literature most of my adult life. So America did not come as something absolutely new or
surprising. I should mention here that you've translated Faulkner and Hemingway into Czechoslovakia.
And, America is my love. I love the country. I love the music. I love the literature. And I like Americans. I know about their faults and so on, and they are quite obvious, But that doesn't mean that that would detract anything from my affection for this country with all its great problems. You know, they always blame the Americans for things like racism and urban poverty and all these things. That's easy to do from Europe, where they don't have these problems. In Prague, where there are no other races but the Czechs, it's easy to criticize a country for its racial problems because the problem doesn't exist. But in the 60s, there was an influx of black students from Africa. I don't know how many, maybe 2,000 of them came to Prague. Not from the States, these were all African students. And immediately we had a racial problem. We had the same attitudes, they called them black mouth, which was a very dirty word. Immediately you had these stupid people who developed a dislike towards them because they were different, and suddenly you had a typical racial problem in a country which always had criticized the States for its inability to solve this very complex problem satisfactorily in a very short time. So I am, again, you know, I, of course, having been a student of American literature and culture, I am very well aware of this problem and others. But I think that at least people are trying very hard here. And I think that the situation is much better than it was, you know, and hopefully it will get better. So if you love something, you don't stop loving the object because it has some faults, or, you know, you only hope that the faults will get less and less, you know, prominent and so. So I feel very happy in America. I really love it, even those strange, dirty cities, you know, and all that. Buffalo, and whenever I want to refresh myself, I go to Buffalo, you know, which is probably ridiculous, but I love Buffalo, for instance.
I used to live there. I liked it quite a bit when I lived there.
Yes, it's, to me, that the atmosphere is something that for a European, it is so different from Europe. I must tell you, when I go to Europe now, I was in Spain this summer, you know, writing a book with an old Czech actress. And I was looking forward to coming back to North America. You know, I no longer feel at home there. I used to love Paris, you know. I still like it. But I feel much more at home in Toronto or in Buffalo or Chicago. You know.
Joseph Sworecki is my guest, if you're just joining us. And you've seen people behaving at their worst during World War II, during the Soviet occupation of Czechoslovakia. And I wonder if that's helped you to lose faith in people or in humanity and in the human condition, or if you've been able to keep intact a sense of optimism and sense of pride in humanity.
Well, you know, all my adult life I was dead set against optimism because it was always forced on me. But in fact, I am, you know, all along I'm an optimist. I think that, of course, there are many bad people, nasty people, and people that are really incredibly nasty and bad. But there are also the other people, you know, who are basically good. They have, again, their faults and all that. And I believe that eventually, if there is any future at all, it may, of course, end in a big bang or something. But if we survive all these perils that are around, then eventually humanity will come to senses, and that the future, I'm not saying that it will be a paradise, you know, I don't believe in utopias, but that it will be livable. You know, you should help me here because Abraham Lincoln once said something which appealed to me very much. I don't know if I'm able to quote it verbatim, but he said that you can fool all the people for some time, and you can fool some people always, but you cannot fool all the people for all the time. And that, I think, is very profound, you know. Because, you know, look at the Germans, you know, during the war, of course, everybody thought, oh, my God, these are the murderers, the killers, you know, if you are German, you are a killer. Now, 20, 25 years after the war, West Germany is a very democratic state with people who speak the language, the sound of which I irrationally don't like very much because it associates with things, but I try to fight that. But they are nice people, very hospitable, and many of them more democratic than any. So I believe that humanity can, you know, grow up somehow. It's probably a long process and a hard process, but historically speaking, I'm an optimist. Personally, I'm a pessimist. You know, I don't believe that I will live to, for instance, see my old country free again because, you know, the Russians are there and they are going to stay as long as they can. I'm afraid I can't stay there for very long. So personally, I'm a pessimist, but I think that unless there is some real great worldwide tragedy, that humanity will eventually develop to a better kind of living. You can see that, you know, in spite of all those upheavals and revolution. On the general level, you know, there simply people live better.
You are now writing in a much more hospitable climate, living in Toronto. Has the themes that concern you in your literature changed as your environment changed?
No, you know, I am one of those persons who can write anywhere. And as I told you, since there are so many Czechs in Toronto and in North America, so I can continue writing about the people I know best in another setting. And I consider myself to be now a real exiled author. That means I write about Czechs in America, using even their language. You know, I think that's quite all right. I don't believe in this you know, weepy attitudes. By God, they have driven me out of my country, and here in this foreign world I will perish because it's so alien. It's not alien, it's different, you know, but basically people are very similar everywhere, you know. When I teach at the university and when I see the young people with their problems, well, my God, are exactly the same problems that we had in the German protectorate, you know. So people speak different languages and they are, have certain different local customs and attitudes, but basically they are very similar. So, and the Czechs who live in America are simply Czechs, like a tribe, you know. They speak a dialect of Czech, which is, of course, permeated with English. So I don't feel any estrangement or any lostness or alienation.
Do your books have any distribution through an underground in Czechoslovakia now?
Oh, yes, they do. You know, my wife founded a publishing house 10 years ago now, the 68 Publishers in Toronto, and that has grown quite considerably. We are now publishing about 22 titles every year. And these books, I don't really know the exact numbers, but about between 200 and 300 copies of each book are smuggled into Czechoslovakia. And there, of course, the people who have them, each of them has friends, you know, and they borrow it and they again lend it to other friends. So that, for instance, people who own a book have a long waiting list, and they just, people can borrow it for 1 or 2 days and then they must return it. So there is, I am not saying that the readership is very wide, but it is influential because people who dare to risk, you know, reading a forbidden book are probably much better politically and much more developed people than people who don't care reading at all, you know. So it reaches an audience of maybe several thousand. And that's a good audience.
You have been called one of the greatest writers of your country and also a voice of conscience within Czechoslovakia, now outside of Czechoslovakia. And your books have been treated as if they were revolutionary statements. And of course, you say that they're about people. They're not political diatribes. But they've obviously been treated as political works and by the government as negatively political works. What kinds of What power do you think literature has as a political statement? And by that I don't mean a political manifesto, but to affect change or to raise consciousness or to give spirit or energy to the people who read it.
Well, first of all, you know, these words are very embarrassing to me when I'm called the greatest writer or as a voice of conscience and so on. I am doing, I hope, my best, but I was a very popular writer, that I won't deny, you know. But whether I was great or small, I don't know. I was very popular. I had really a large readership, and I still have. And as for the political, you know, impact of literature, that's, of course, a very complex question. I would say that there are two possibilities. In a country like this, which is basically, in the ideological sense, very apolitical, because American politics doesn't have much to do with ideology. You know, we have these two parties. They are becoming more, let's say, ideological, quote-unquote. But basically, you know, there is easy transition between them. You know, you have senators, who, Republicans who switch over to, and so on. So in this country, there exists a political fiction which simply is critical of certain you know, social drawbacks of American life, which is directly political. You know, if you take people like James T. Farrell, you know, these are political novels. And there are even more political novels. The early Howard Fast, for instance, he was ideologically political. He was a communist and so on. But if you live in a totalitarian country, so there you are required to be political in the sense of the ruling ideology. If you are not, if you simply write about reality as you see it, so in terms of Western thinking, apolitical, just describe life as it is, you become very political because people say, well, that's how it is. That's not how these other guys are writing. They are just, you know, communists or something. But this one, he writes about life as we know it. And suddenly you become, in this sense, very political. So, for instance, the cowards, which, as I say, certainly contain no ideology, became very political because people said, well, that's how it was. This is the truth. Not as it was described in other books, you know, the end of the war, the ideology books, because that's nonsense, the heroes and the villains and so on. This is how it was. And that's why I became, in this sense, a political writer. And then, of course, came the ban. And as soon as you ban something, so, of course, you become a center of a political controversy. And in that sense, you become political. But I myself was never a member of any party, you know, and I always mistrusted all ideologies. I believe that in many of them there are, you know, pieces of truth, but they are always overdone, you know. So socialism, well, why not? That's a good idea, you know, social justice and so. But once you become a Marxist-Leninist, you know, an ideological man, so you start distorting things. I would have to give a whole lecture on that, you know. So I was never an ideological person. I was very naive politically, you know, for many years. But I try. That was my natural way of looking at things. You know, I just look at things and describe them as I saw them. That was all. And that became a major point of controversy.
Do you have any political problems now living in Toronto? Do you feel perfectly free to participate in whatever activities you please and to say what you please, or is there any pressure on you?
Oh, I don't think there are any pressures on me. As I said, we publish these books, and I write for several Czech magazines where I express views with no pressure at all. You know, I really feel very free in Canada.
I'm glad.
I'm glad too.
I thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for inviting me here. It was a pleasure.